The stories of some of the world's greatest women unfold here. I am Annette Comer, your host, and each week, the untold secrets of success, strength, and boldness of today's powerful women are revealed. Today's guest grew up with seven siblings in the Bahamas. Her parents earned very little money. Therefore, she grew up in very basic surroundings. In spite of being poor, she loved to learn and would often sneak off to the library to read as much as she could. At age 15, she graduated high school and found the money to go off to college and earn a degree in biochemistry. While working as a waitress, a woman offered her a job as a chemist. She took it, and here she thrived. And as the years flew by, she married, had children, and went on to get her doctorate focused on social-emotional learning. Today, she is walking her path to greatness as she teaches children and adults how to deal with emotions and relationships. It is my pleasure to introduce you to Dr. Marilyn Simons-Bowe. Hi, Marilyn. Thank you for joining me today.
Good morning, Arnette. Thank you so much for having me.
And I am so excited to have you with me today, Marilyn. So let's get started. You started your career as a chemist, but now teach children and adults about emotions. Why and how did you make this career switch?
The career switch came initially out of necessity. Once I migrated to the United States with two children as a new divorcee, I had to find a new career that would allow me to be on and off with my children. And so I started teaching in the inner cities of Miami-Dade County. As my teaching career progressed, I became more and more interested in not only what people learn, but how they learn and why emotions and how emotions were so crucial to this journey. And so I embarked upon my PhD in social emotional learning, and I parlayed that into a bootstrap career where I teach in public schools, train and teach both adults and children. And in my private practice, I do the same.
Was it a good switch for you? Because it's really quite a change from being in a very technical field, being in the chemistry side of things. And then you moved over to teaching, certainly wasn't a strange switch, but you moved over to the emotions, which is very much, I want to say, a softer side of the world as opposed to the science side of it.
Absolutely, Annette. You're quite right. I went from the hard sciences, the more hard science, the more quantitative side of life, technically inclined into teaching. However, it wasn't a tremendous switch for me because I always had this knack in my brain of connecting what I saw as soft social actions into what was happening in the brain. So it was almost like whenever I saw something, I went inside and said, what was happening behind the scenes? And so it was very easy for me to take my master's degree in biomedical sciences, where I focused on neuroanatomy and neurophysiology, the workings of the brain, and then bring that into the softer social science environment of teaching. Additionally, I also still teach the hard sciences, so that gives me the best of both worlds.
So obviously, what you just said, education has been your ticket to much success, but it has also brought hardship. Because of your education, your mom beat you and your husband divorced you. So tell our listeners why this was and why you kept on learning.
Well, my mom never made it past third grade. She was born in 1929. Today, she lives happily in West Palm Beach, approaching her 93rd birthday. However, back in 1978, when I graduated high school, my mom still had eight kids under her roof. And as far as she was concerned, you're legal at the age of 18. You can go out and you can get a job and you can be an adult. Well, here it was, as she said, I was too stupid to stay in school until 18 like everybody else. I came out at 15 and turned 16 that summer. What was she going to do with me? Naturally, she was frustrated. My mom had a really tough upbringing, and then to be left with eight children that she had to raise. So yes, and I understand, and that's what how I can use my previous experiences and bring them into social emotional learning, because then I can see both sides of it. I understood, even as a 15-year-old, that there was something about what I was doing that my mom could not relate to. And the only way that she could manifest that was through frustration. Fast forward years later with the situation with my husband, and I wanted to go off to school because we did not have advanced degree opportunities in the Bahamas. So the agreement was, before marriage, there was the only prenup was that however many kids we get, when the last child gets 5, I'll go off to school. But when that time came, my husband thought that I was so settled into marriage life that I would have forgotten my ideals, my goals of extending my education. And so he told me, if you go back to school, I'll divorce you. I did 120 credits in 2 calendar years. And every night it was, if you don't drop out of school, I'll divorce you. Every night on the telephone. Every other weekend when I went home. Every alternating weekend when they came to the U.S. And so this is how both of my educational endeavors, graduating high school, getting my initial associate's degree, and then eventually getting my master's and my PhD, caused me greatly.
I'm going to stay with this just for a second, because there's something you said that's very interesting. Your husband threatened and followed through with divorcing you because you pursued a higher education. Why do you think that was? Do you think it was a threat to him? Does it his own identity? Or why do you think that was, now that you look back?
Well, not only now that I look back on that, but also because my husband and I never had an argument a day in our life, and we remain very good friends. He's remarried, and we always congregate with he and his new family. And I think at the time, he was not mature enough to understand the true passion of education. You know, growing up, everybody always used to use the little vernacular, oh, you always were a little smart. But I don't think that they really understood deep down inside of me, the scholarly yearning that I always had, and the fact that I knew that education was the only thing that got me out of poverty and out of the circumstances in which I was born. And so at the time, I think he was threatened by the fact that the structure, not so much that I felt that he was insecure, but that he was threatened by this, the fact that me going off to school would undermine the structure that he had built as a man. This is his family, and this is his wife, and no one else's wife is going off to school, and why do you have to be the only one? And so that's the kind of stuff that I encountered through it all. And like I said, we never argued. He talked about it, and he kept giving me the ultimatum. I finally said, go ahead and file the papers.
Yeah. Well, after you hear that so long, it starts to kill some of the love, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I always tell people, it wasn't that I had a broken heart. It was that I had a great amount of disappointment, because we had such a strong foundation of friendship before we married and had children, to the point that the friendship was violated. So that's why I felt tremendous disappointment. Just, for want of a better term, yes, brokenheartedness would come into it, but not from a romantic point of view, just from a structurally sound, hey, I thought we were better than this point of view.
So I'm going to move to a little different direction here. You told me that you see compromise as a bad deal for women, yet women are the masters of compromise. Explain what you meant and what they should do instead.
I feel that compromise is a bad thing for women in particular, and everyone overall, because whenever a compromise is set up, someone always loses. Unfortunately, people present a compromise as though it's a win-win. The whole concept of the word compromise means that somebody has to be, or something has to be diminished in order for the other thing to shine. And so I do not agree and do not believe that women should compromise at all. I think as an alternative to compromising, that we should accommodate, because when we accommodate, everybody wins. And we can see this in the hard sciences. When you look out in nature, if you see a vine growing on a tree, if that vine smothers the leaves, that's a compromise. That tree is going to eventually die because its leaves won't get any sunshine. But if those vines only stay on the trunk until they can get high enough to get their own sunshine, then that's an accommodation. The tree is accommodating the vine and on its branches. And meanwhile, the tree can still get its leaves exposed to sunlight. In our personal lives, if someone says, okay, I want to be to work at 8 o'clock, and the other person says, I have to be to work at 8 o'clock, and we only have one car. If we compromise, somebody is going to get to work late. However, if we accommodate by saying, okay, why don't we both get up a little earlier? You can drop me off or I can drop you off early and then I can get to work. That way we've accommodated. Both people can get to work on time and that is a win-win.
And I think that's beautiful wisdom because I think that women think that when they compromise, they're doing the right thing and they don't realize that they're hurting their whole position of power in a relationship.
Absolutely. And that makes me think about choice theory. The premise of choice theory, which is something that I use inherently in my social emotional learning training, as well as coaching. And when I explain choice theory, I explain it basically from the point of view of the meaning of the word choice, or to choose. And to choose means that we use the power within us to bring about some circumstance that would hopefully benefit us. Sure, we make bad choices or wrong choices or negative choices. And as we all know, if we use that power to choose in a negative way or in a contrary way, it's not going to bring about something positive. And it's the same thing with compromise. If we choose to compromise, then we are choosing, we're using our power to bring about something that's going to put us in a deficit more so than in an accommodating circumstance or positive circumstance.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm going to stay with your comment about choice theory because that's going to lead into what my next question is. So I've heard you talk a lot about choice theory in our conversations and how it relates to women and power. In that space, how does it play into women understanding what they want so that they can make the right choice?
A very good question, Annette. And it comes down to the cultural box that has been established for women. And you've spoken to many women all over the United States and parts of the world. And you know full well that culturally, there seems to be this same invisible box in which women are placed. We should know our place. We should only venture so far. If we go outside of the status quo, there is a consequence, a social consequence. And as a social emotional learning coach, what I say in my trainings and in my life coaching or couple coaching or whatever type of coaching I happen to be doing, I say, when you use choice in a way that's going to undermine your power in any relationship, what you're saying to the other person is that you are accepting less than. Then on the other hand, let's say a woman in industry, the way that you and I were in industry or many powerful women in industry, when we walk into a room, there's a preconceived notion that we should already be walking a step behind. When we choose otherwise, when we choose to bring ourselves to the table as equals, because of choice theory, we're using the power within us along with our equal or even higher qualifications sometimes to say, I belong here. We are seen as a pariah. We are seen as bossy. We are seen as aggressive. Why are you doing this? Nobody thinks about choice theory as being a power tool for women, but they think about it as being a power tool for men.
That is so on target, Marilyn, and I see it play out in front of me all the time. And, you know, I think women intuitively feel this, but they also realize they're marked by society. And so it takes courage to practice this choice theory, doesn't it?
Absolutely, Annette. And as the saying goes, it's lonely at the top. Well, it's also lonely when you choose to use your internal choice power to empower yourself. And as we spoke in our initial conversation, we talked about the fact that we both do not like the idea of how the word empowerment is thrown around. Empowerment, the prefix M means that we have to have some kind of conglomeration in order to bring about power. I do not like the concept of empowerment being thrown around casually because it implies that internally, I do not have enough power to come to the table and make a choice. I have to gather. Yes, we should congregate for mutual purposes, but I should not have to gather, quote unquote, to be empowered. I should gather and co-join my empowerment, bring my choice theory, my decision theory, my ability to use my power to make decisions so that together we can be enhanced. But when we decide to compromise our power, either to go along to get along or to diminish our power so that somebody else feels better, then we are lying to ourselves, we are demeaning ourselves. And above all, we're saying to God, to the universe, you know what? I'm not really able to use all of this that you gave me, or I don't want to be such a bright light. I don't want to make somebody else feel bad. And so I'm just going to reduce myself a little bit. Once we start doing that, we have set a precedent. It's going to be hard for us to reverse that course. It's going to be like trying to turn a huge bend in the narrow section of Mississippi. You will never get it to happen.
I'm going to stay with this for a second because I think it speaks to so much of what's happening in our culture today, Marilyn. Many women are frustrated and discouraged and saddened by many of the things they see unfolding in terms of how women are treated. I heard this past weekend about the woman on the train in Pennsylvania who was being raped and nobody did anything. And I think those kinds of things speak loudly of how our society views women and the value of them. And women are frustrated by this, but in some ways, they've kind of made their own bed. And I know maybe some of those listening, you know, kind of recoiling at that comment, but we have to have that courage to step up and make that choice and demand that we be treated as equals.
Absolutely, Annette. And I want to comment on the point that you made about women making their own beds. Women have compromised to the point of individual success. So they say, you know what? I'll do this. I'll go along. I'll turn a blind eye when my boss does this or my supervisor does that, because I know that if I go along with them, that's going to help me to get to the next level or get to the next level, even if it's at the expense of other women. Then when women, especially in education, and I know those in educational listening are probably going to recoil, but I have worked in 4 states, 7 school districts over the last 26 years. And I find in education that women at the top have decided to become the taskmaster for the male supervisors or the male administrators that are above them, to the point that you have to look long and hard to find women in the field of education that I've adopted in the last 26 years who have enough compassion to say, let me allow you to use your power as a woman. Now, to expand my comment beyond the field of education, you're absolutely right again in that women have decided that, hey, once I get mine, I might let you as another woman get a little bit, but not too much. And then they feel like, if I have been given this opportunity, I must be aggressive. I must be this taskmaster. I must keep my foot on your neck. I will not allow you to make choices. I don't care if you're smarter than me. I don't care if you've had more experience than me. You will not outshine me. And the greatest underlying fear as to why that happens within them, Annette, is because they know that the positions that they have are not able to be substantiated based on their qualifications. And so when they find someone else, like myself, who are more qualified, they're going to automatically use choice theory and decide that I am an enemy and they will do anything to undermine me. Then men see this and men go, all I need is a couple of good women at the top to help me keep my power and keep all the other ambitious women like Marilyn at bay.
Yeah, an interesting perspective. And I'm sure so much of that goes on. And well, there's so many few positions at the top that I think women do kind of hold those sacred and don't want to share them. And we do a disservice to the sisterhood in general when we do that. And we foster the power of men even further, which is disappointing. So during your PhD work, you studied white and black students.
Yes.
So you studied two different cultural dimensions. What did you discover from your work?
Well, thank you for that question, Annette. When my PhD research question was, can emotions be used to predict science outcomes and for Black students compared to white students? And the reason that I chose that research question is because at the time that I started my PhD work back in 2008, right up to the current day, there is still a 39 to 45% achievement gap between Blacks and whites in science. And so it was always said that, well, even among Blacks, working in the inner cities of Miami, Savannah, Atlanta, in rural cities like Albany, Georgia, Black students would always say to me, and Black parents would say to me, oh, my baby ain't gonna do good in science because I didn't do good in science. So it seemed to me that there was an emotional, generational acceptance that Black people didn't do well in science. And so here I come and I'm saying, but science was my way out. I graduated high school at 15, got an associate's degree at age 17 in science. And they're going, really? Oh, that's because you are foreign Black. No, Black, you know, here in America, we don't, you know. And they go, yeah, all the smart Black scientists are foreigners. And all the smart people are of any color are foreigners or they're white. And so it was a social mindset. And so I decided to study this phenomenon. So I did a quantitative self-design, a PhD. And the reason that it had to be self-designed was because no university was offering the course of study that I wanted to do. So I had to make a proposal, get it approved, so that I can get permission to design my own PhD. And then, of course, I had my mentor and different checkpoints throughout the university system to make sure that everything was adhering to the accreditation. But when I studied the students, I actually did my sample population was out of Southwest Georgia, Albany, and I looked at Black students versus white students. And what I did was I used an existing questionnaire that measured what their dominant positive emotion and negative emotions would look like as the independent or as the variable that I was interested in studying. And then I use as the dependent variable, sorry. And then I use their existing science results from their most recent state test as the independent variable to see if, based on their responses, if I would be able to overlay their response results to what their actual test scores were. And so I looked at eight discrete achievement emotions, 5 negative, anger, anxiety, hopelessness, boredom, and shame, 3 positive, joy, hope, and pride. Then I looked at 4 neurological domains, cognitive, how do they think? Affective, how do they feel? Motivational, are they naturally driven? And physiological or physical, do they need a physical outcome to help them to achieve or a physical manifestation of some kind to help them to achieve? Then I looked at time frames. Are they best at achievement before an event? Yeah, I got this. During an event? Oh, I may need a little help along the way. Or after an event? Oh, I could have done better. Oh, man, I didn't do as well. Or, wow, I did great. So in looking at that, what I found for Black students was that their number one negative emotion, the thing that they felt was stopping them from achieving in science, was boredom. Usually boredom is followed by anger, but anger is never leading boredom. Now you might ask, why is boredom so crucial? In the brain, boredom is a flat line. In the heart, if someone's connected to an EKG machine and God forbid they pass away, what's going to happen? It's going to flatline. There's no more electricity going through the heart. Well, boredom in the brain with an EEG machine, electroencephalograph, which measures the energy in the brain, if somebody is bored, that energy line is going to be almost flatline. There is going to be no blips of connection, of recognition of, yeah, I'm with you. And so when the students responded to these questions are simple statements like, I get excited about learning, strongly agree, 5, strongly disagree, 1. And I took all those numbers, put them through a myriad of statistical rigor, because I did a quantitative study. I did multiple regression, two-tailed t-test, area under the curve. I did a lot of rigor because I wanted these results to matter, not for me and my PhD, but in order to be able to help Black and white students understand how and why they learn the way that they learn. And above all, for teachers and administrators to understand that we should not just be looking at academic data to see whether a child can read, write, or do arithmetic, but more importantly, looking at social emotional learning data, because that is going to be the true driver of not only instruction, but also academic excellence.
So the interesting thing that I particularly gleaned from your explanation is that our judgments and pre-assumptions about why African-American children do not excel in the sciences is really flawed, and that we actually almost create the scenario that we assume as opposed to looking at it differently. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So, Marilyn, is there anything about your journey to greatness that we haven't covered that you'd like to share with other women?
Well, I am an avid runner. Thank you for that question. In addition to being a scientist turned educator, I'm a long distance runner. And that long distance running journey was started again from a social emotional learning point of view, because here I was, a happy 200-pound housewife, who felt lost, who felt a little frustrated, but at the same time, I could get everything I wanted to eat and I could hire someone to take my kids for a walk. And then one day, I was pre-diabetic and I went out to the driveway as the young lady was bringing my children back from a walk. And I just decided to play with my little son and I ran to one light pole and then I huffed and puffed and walked, then ran to another one. And a year later, that was May of 1989, a year later, in May of 1990, I did my very first marathon. Fast forward to today, I've done 180 marathons in 48 states. I have Alaska and Hawaii left. In addition to being a runner for 32 years, I started something called Run the Year in 2015, where I've run the amount of miles in that year or more every year since 2015. As of today, for 2021, as of this morning, where I run 6.5 miles every day, as of this morning, I am at 1,978 miles. I'm looking forward to getting 2021 done by next week, God willing. And lastly, as an avid runner, I'm also a run streaker. Some of our listeners might be a runner and might know a run streaker or be a run streaker themselves. A run streaker is someone who has run every day for a certain amount of time. I have run every day since January 1st, 2012, and I'm coming up on 10 years of not missing one day of running.
And my guess is that you don't weigh 200 pounds anymore.
No, ma'am.
So the message for those women listening is where you are, you can change by something as simple as running, for sure. Marilyn, I so appreciate you taking time from your schedule to come and share your wisdom. I congratulate you on the amazing life journey that you've already had, and I can't wait to see what the next 30 years unfold for you as you move to even higher levels of greatness.
Thank you so much, Annette. Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for doing the wonderful work that you are doing.
And Marilyn is another great example of how women are challenging the norm, making things happen, and demanding their own greatness. So join me next time on the World's Greatest Women Show as another powerful woman story unfolds.